Hard for him to be here for this.
He's not my favorite person.
I just saw him. There he is. There they are.
Have I looked at my taxes?
Good morning. I'd like to open the House Committee on Business and Labor.
Well, I don't have to say.
So let's go ahead and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 462A.
Committee members, Mr. Chair, this measure changes provisions of the Secure Transactions section of the Uniform Commercial Code. Provides that a record is effective as a financing statement if the record satisfies the requirement for financing statement and sufficiently provides the name of the debtor. And it requires a financing statement to show the name of the individual debtor as indicated on a driver's license or identification card. Provides a phase-in period for the financing statements perfected under current law. Declares an emergency, no amendment, no revenue, no fiscal, and the Senate vote on this measure was 28-0.
So up first, let's have Senator Floyd Przanski, Tim Martinez, and Ron Sherman. Oh, Ken Sherman.
Ken.
Sorry,
Ken Sherman.
Sorry, Ken.
Yeah.
Him too.
You'll have to re-examine your cave.
Okay, my mother wanted a doctor.
Oh, you wrote it for him?
Yeah.
That figures. Good morning. Could you introduce yourself for the record, please?
Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Floyd Przanski. I'm a state senator from District 4, which includes parts of Lane and Douglas County. Thank you very much for allowing me to be part of the first panel on our bill that's before you, Senate Bill 462. This bill is one that has been in front of our committee on the Senate side for a number of years, I believe probably 4 or 5 years. Thereabouts, on at least two full sessions. This is, and you'll be hearing from Mr. Martinez and Mr. Sherman as to the purpose of what the bill will accomplish. I've been asked to kind of lay out my perspective on the bill and why I'm now in support of the bill, and which actually will move our state from what is known as a B state to an A state. And what that is that there's a uniform commission that decided that they were going to put out two different alternatives for the states within the country to look at how to preserve and protect and perfect a filing for a UCC filing on Article 9. When we first approached this, we looked at and relied on the Oregon Law Commission, who is, as most of you probably know, the body that this legislature refers a lot of matters to go into great detail and analysis and work. I have been a member of the Oregon Law Commission. I now may be excommunicated because of my position that I've taken. Chair Shutterly will let you know after I finish my presentation this morning. The bottom line is that I made a commitment to the banks and other lending institutions that we would watch and see how this played out on a national basis. At the time, we had multiple states that were looking at both A and B, and you had the separation of which direction we're going to go. In the last 2 to 3 years, we've seen that mark actually really shift to the A side of the argument. My understanding, there are now 45 states that have gone with the A version, and on the West Coast, every state on the West Coast and in the near West to us and all of our bordering states have the A model. I've decided that this is the time that we need to have uniformity, and this is continuity for lenders within this area, and so that is why I'm here and why I'm in support of it. I will tell you, and I think Lane will also revisit this, that when this came up again, knowing that we're going to be looking at it during this session, that the Law Commission looked at this issue again, and they still believe that the B is more appropriate for the state. I think this is where I'm going to say good individuals have a difference of opinion as to what is the best way to go. I just feel at this point, with the number of states that have taken on the A version of perfection, that this is the appropriate way for us to go, that uniformity.
Thanks. Go ahead, Tim? Senator, do you need to take off?
I have about 10 minutes.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Tim Martinez here on behalf of the Oregon Bankers Association as well as the Independent Community Banks of Oregon. As I look up on the dais this morning, I think Senator Przanski might like to have some of you over there because I think there's twice as many lawyers on this committee as are on your Senate Judiciary Committee.
There's only one.
I know. There's two here. But thank you very much, Chair Holvey, for having a hearing on this bill, and thank you, Senator Przanski, for introducing this bill on our behalf. If it's okay with you, Mr. Chair, I would give just a real thumbnail sketch on what we're accomplishing here. I think Senator Przanski did a great job. I also have Ken Sherman Jr. If I could spell or make my Ken's better, K's better, and he is my technical expert as always. So if there are technical questions, he can certainly answer it and maybe talk a little bit about the transition amendment, which was added in the Senate. For those of you that don't know, Uniform Commercial Code is nine different articles that deal with various commercial transactions. And in this case, the national group, of which former Representative Shetterly is a national commissioner, looked at how to update and modernize UCC-9. They did that in a great manner. We're very happy with, and I think with what they've done in developing the Article 9 update. They left it to the states to basically decide what was going to constitute identification. And I should tell you, if you're incorporated, you have no choice. You must use your corporate name. You can't use anything else. This is for individuals that are businesses but are not necessarily incorporated. And basically, as Senator Przanski said, there was two options given to the states. A, which is the one we're here and we prefer today, and 45 other states have gone down that road, is basically a driver's license or a state-issued identification card. And we believe, and all these other states believe, that most folks in business, if not virtually all folks in business, will have one or the other. If they don't, there are methods of also using your name, an appropriate name. B is more of a list, and you can go and down and really pick and choose what you want to use depending on the case. That, as you can imagine, might cause some problems. My driver's license says Timothy Wayne Martinez. I'm also getting mail as Tim Martinez. I get mail as T.W. Martinez. I get mail as Wayne Martinez. And in high school, my nickname was Buck. So there's a lot of different ways to get a hold of Tim Martinez. This, we think, simplifies things. It'll make it much better for, if you look on the Oregon and Washington border, where there's a lot of business transactions across the river. Same thing with Idaho and Oregon. There's a lot of business across the river between Boise and Ontario. So as I say, there are 45 other states. Washington went along with what Oregon did initially. They went with B. And then a year later, they went back and revisited and said, it looks like the majority of states are going A. So we want to be there. And again, this isn't just a large bank issue. If you look at Umpqua Bank, if you look at Banner Bank and others that are in several Northwest states and down into California, this affects them as well. So it's not a big bank issue. It has nothing to do with single family mortgages or MERS or anything like that. This is simply a Uniform Commercial Code Article 9 revision dealing with what constitutes identification. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions. Actually, I'd be happy to have Mr. Sherman answer any questions, but maybe I can handle simple.
Representative Barton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Przanski, before you take off, is it my understanding from your testimony, and I just want to, is the primary driver for you, is it uniformity, or is it, do you actually have personal policy preference about A versus B? It's my understanding from your testimony is uniformity is the primary motivator for you. Is that right?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, Representative Barton, that's correct. I think uniformity, consistency, knowing how the uniform commission is basically giving the states options. And we've looked at this, and I've told Mr. Martinez that I would consider this periodically as we went forward. And like I said, I think this is at least the third session that we've had the bill. And I was convinced at that point that we had a certainty. We now have the complete West Coast and near West states that are all going with the A. And it does, in fact, give that, for business dealings, that uniformity of having two means of identifying the person so you can perfect. You will hear, I think this is something that hopefully Tim or Mr. Sherman will bring forward, this transitional amendment that we put in so we can show how those that have already been perfected, how they will, in fact, be honored, and how there will be the process of them shifting into the A model, the form that's necessary, and the notice that will be coming from the Secretary of State's office to accomplish that.
Follow-up question, Senator Prezanski. I have some questions for Ms. Martinez and Sherman after, but I know your time is limited. It is intriguing to see you, because I know that you serve on the Oregon Law Commission, to see you here in opposition and on the other side. It's interesting to me. And I'm wondering...
like I said, I may be excommunicated.
But I'm wondering how much deference you think is appropriate that a committee like this, which is it's not the Judiciary Committee, on a technical matter, how much deference do you think is appropriate that we give the Uniform Law Commission, the Oregon Law Commission? I mean, they do a lot of work for no money and generally do good work of it. And so it's interesting to me. I'm just wondering how, if you were on our side, you would wrestle with that.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, Representative Barton, clearly you want me to be excommunicated.
Sorry.
All right, so here's the situation. I have all the respect for the Oregon Law Commission. I believe that this legislature, in its wisdom, actually asked a group of individuals, as you said, virtually are volunteers, with the exception of the staff, to actually be able to take detailed issues that are very legal focused, that need to have the ability that we don't have as a body, as a legislature, to embark on. And their work and studies take time. It's not something that's done in a week, 2 weeks. I mean, we're talking sometimes years for them to come back. So I give them a lot of respect and honor a lot of the decisions. But I think there are times where we may just have to agree to disagree. Mm-hmm. This is one, this is the only one that I know in my career of working as a legislator that I have had a difference of opinion, and it is for me.
I've never seen you do it before.
It's the uniformity part, and I know that Lane will make his position for the commission why they think having more options is appropriate. I would just say that when you look at the type of transactions that we have, who are involved in those type of transactions, to ensure that you are actually perfecting title or interest in whatever property that's being secured, it seems to have a set means of knowing that you've got the right name on that farm is appropriate. So it's just, let's say, a lot of admiration, and clearly I will continue to rely on the Law Commission in the future. It's just that for my journey on this for 4 years or whatever length of time we've had, I feel that we're now at a point that my commitment was to go forward once I saw how the states were playing out. We have 45 that have done it.
Other questions for Senator Prezanski specifically?
Just a question in general.
Representative Doherty.
A quick question or comment. Now, with interstate banking transactions, does this help the situation at all? Because if I have property and have taken out a loan in the state of Washington, the state of Nevada, whatever, does this kind of stop some of the confusion possibly in if I'm no longer here in, probate, that kind of thing?
Mr. Chair, Representative Jordan, yes, it does. That's the reason I think it's important, because now that we have 45 states that are under the A formula for those type of transactions, it's not like, okay, what is Oregon using versus Nevada, everyone understands, at least on the West Coast, out of 45 states, this is the information we need. The farms will be, I mean, it will just become second nature. We need your driver's license or your state ID card, and we'll take the information off of that, and that's how what we need. Instead of having some other supplemental identification purposes. That's, again, why I, as they have stepped over that line and have put myself in harm's way of the commission.
Okay. And then just a comment. I tend to support this more since you did not give us a lecture on Universal Commercial Code. Thank you very much. Those of us that have sat through
Mr.
it,
Shirley
thank you
will
very
do
much.
That, I'm sure.
Yeah. No, that's coming. It's coming.
I hope my colleagues on both sides understand that. We'll see if Mr. Shirley wants to embark on that.
Thanks. I know we have some more questions, but I think Mr. Sherman and Mr. Martinez can probably handle the rest of the questions. If not, we'll call you back.
Okay. Thank you very much.
And you can come at your discretion.
Yeah. Thanks for coming to the dark side.
Other questions? Representative Barton.
Thank you. Question for either one of you. Two questions, if the chair will allow it. The first question is, does this bill in any way affect or influence transactions of real property?
I think perhaps I can best answer that, Representative Barton.
Introduce yourself, Mr.
I am Ken Sherman. I'm counsel to the Oregon Bankers. I'm a lawyer who practices here in Salem. The only place where this would affect a mortgage is where the mortgage is being filed as a financing statement in the Uniform Commercial Code filings with the Secretary of State. Occasionally, in order to pick up fixtures that are part of the security, you will actually use the mortgage, which is covers the real property. You also use just double duty that to file it with the Secretary of State. So that's the only situation where it would affect the mortgage.
But in general, no?
Yes, in general,
follow up,
no.
Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
Next question. Does this bill in any way influence or affect a person's duties or responsibilities to file trust deed?
Representative Barton, no, it does not.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Other questions? So perhaps you can explain to me, other than the uniformity, I understand. So you're basically going to be able to search and use a name, the driver's license name, for legal documents. Why is that a better thing, I guess, and why does that uniformity really matter in this situation?
Mr. Chairman, uniformity, I think, matters because we're increasingly involved in interstate transactions, and those who are involved, whether it's a bank or some other person who's providing financing, or sometimes it will be a dealer that's selling some sort of equipment or machinery or whatever, and taking a security interest. Those people need to have a single set of rules, and if they are dealing in any of the cross-border kinds of situations that Tim mentioned, it's going to be much simpler for them if they know that whether I'm dealing with an Idaho borrower or with collateral that's located in California or whatever, we're dealing with the same rule as to what name do I put on the financing statement. The other thing that I think is important to remember, it's not just about what name the bank or whoever the creditor is puts on the financing statement. It's also what name do you search under when you're trying to determine whether this particular debtor has already created a security interest in the same collateral. Because if you're number one on the list, that means you have the prior position, and if something goes wrong with your credit, then you're going to be able to move against that collateral and you don't have to worry about a bunch of other competing creditors. If you're number four or five on that list, you're probably out of luck. That collateral is not going to be worth anything to you. So simplicity in terms of conducting the search is extremely important in the situation too. And that applies it's going to be helpful to the financial institutions. It's going to be, in my opinion, even more helpful to the non-financial institution situation where you've got a borrower, a lender or a dealer or whoever it is that's making the credit extension who knows, I've got a very simple rule here. I search for competing security interests under the name that's on the driver's license.
So perhaps if you could follow, if Tim Martinez here sold a tractor to, you know, somebody, mm-hmm. and that person then went to a lender to say, I want to borrow some money against my tractor, mm-hmm. and so you do a search, you search, but he's as you said, is actually his driver's license is Timothy Wayne.
Thank you, Mom.
But when he did this transaction, he did it as Tim. So you do a search as the banker for Timothy, and you don't see anything on Timothy Wayne, and so you then establish a first position, I guess. And does Tim get shorted then?
Well, I'm not sure in your example, Mr. Chairman, whether Tim financed the sale. In other words, this person.
Yes, he did, because it was his. It was his tractor. He sold it on time.
So he took a security
interest as Tim.
Okay. What he should have done under these new rules, once they are fully effective, is to ask the guy to whip out his driver's license and use that name. It's not Tim's name at that point that we're worried about. It's the buyer's name.
Buyer's name, okay.
So
what if the buyer used Buck instead of his real name or something?
If Buck's on his driver's license and whoever is financing this.
My question, if his driver's license is not Buck and it's Tim.
Right. Okay.
So where's the lender? Does the lender then go into the first position? And how does that?
Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, let me take a shot at that. I think it's my understanding in having a brief conversation with the Secretary of State's office, the division that's responsible for this, is when this bill goes into effect, there'll be a notice on the filing page that says Oregon law has changed, and the if available, you should be using a driver's license or an identification card. So if I sold that tractor to somebody and I filed the proper UCC-9 form, I would be required to use that driver's license or ID's name, or ID name on the ID, and if that's not there, then there would be other options. So the example you give, I know that's one of the arguments that we've heard from the other side, that should be fairly eliminated. I also know they've talked about attorneys perhaps making mistakes on what they file. The Oregon State Bar does a wonderful job every year of putting out what the changes are in the law. And again, even if they're not familiar with all those, if they don't do a good job of looking through those changes as attorneys, when they get to that website, it will, I'm not sure it's going to flash, but it'll make it very clear that under the new law, you're now supposed to use driver's license name or a state-issued ID card. And I guess I would just also say, I don't know the last time, and again, not everything we buy is a Uniform Commercial Code Article 9, but I would just look to the committee and ask the last thing they bought of any major cost if the seller did not ask them for their driver's license. You know, whatever we buy nowadays, that seems to become our merchant's accepted form of identification.
Yeah, I guess the point I was trying to get at. So, I mean, if this change goes into effect, what happens to transactions that already occurred where somebody did use a different name, or he used Tim instead of Timothy Wayne, or whatever the case may be? So is that?
And Mr. Chairman, that brings us to the transition rules, which is really what Tim brought me down here to talk about. The transition rules were added to the bill. There are sections, I think, 3 to 11 in the A.N. Grost bill by the Senate. They are designed to deal exactly with that situation. what is the rule where a financing statement was appropriately filed, correctly filed under the old rules, and now we're moving into this period post January 1 of 16 when the new rules apply. Well, that financing statement under these transition rules will still be effective. It will be unaffected until it comes time for until it expires or it's renewed by the filing of a continuation statement. At that point, then you have to jump on board and comply with the new rules. These are essentially, you've already passed these transition rules as a part of the legislation in 2012 when we did the big amendment to Article 9. That was House Bill 4035. And these same rules, almost word for word, these transition rules were in that bill. Because every time you make a major change in this body of law, you need to have those rules that say, well, what do we do during this transitional period? So those rules which have been added, which respond to your problem, are already part of the law for the 2012 Act. Now that we're changing this portion, this smaller portion of Article 9, again, we need to again adopt the transition rules to get us through this new transition.
Any other questions? Not seeing any at this point. Thank you very much, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So we'll hear from Lane Shetterly, Walt Goel,
Gallo,
and Mark Comstock. Apologize if I mispronounce your name.
Gallo.
If you'd introduce yourself for the record before you give your testimony, that'd be great.
Sure, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Lane Shetterly. I'm an attorney in private practice over in Dallas, and as Tim and my apostate friend, Senator Pruszynski, already mentioned, I'm actually here. I have two hats on today. Well, three when you count practicing lawyer in a small town. One is I am a member of the Uniform Law Commission from Oregon. Our commissioners are appointed by the governor, and the Uniform Law Commission is the body, the national body, that writes, in this case, the Uniform Commercial Code and periodically amends and updates it. The amendments to Article 9 were done in 2010, and when those amendments were done, we here in Oregon took those amendments to the Oregon Law Commission, which you created, the legislature created back in 1998. And it's actually within the scope of the Oregon Law Commission to review uniform acts from the Uniform Law Commission and tailor them to Oregon, and in this case, evaluate options that are presented in the uniform acts and adopt Oregon appropriate or recommend Oregon appropriate alternatives for enactment. Let me just say, at the Uniform Law Commission level, the Uniform Law Commission proposes statutes for the states to adopt to create uniformity in areas where uniformity is appropriate and important. Within the Uniform Acts, it is not uncommon, it's not common, but it's far from rare, for the Uniform Law Commission to give states options. And it will do that when the choice between the alternatives within the Uniform Act don't materially affect uniformity. That is, states can adopt either alternative and still have a substantially uniform act. And that's what the Uniform Law Commission did in this case. So when the Oregon Law Commission took up its review of these Article 9 amendments, one of the tasks that the Oregon Law Commission had was to look at the alternatives, in this case, for what, how are we going to require the name of a debtor to appear on a financing statement in order to be perfected, and make a determination which policy, which option is more appropriate for Oregon. In its work, the Oregon Law Commission appoints a work group. In this case, we had a work group of about probably 10 lawyers. I chaired the work group, and the lawyers are drawn from the Bar Association. In this case, we had members of the debtor-creditor section, so we had attorneys who represent both debtors and creditors. We had the Farm Bureau. We had the Bankers Association. After probably a nine-month effort, that work group completed its review of the Article 9 amendments and made a recommendation to the full law commission that included adoption of alternative B, which is what we have in law now. The Oregon Law Commission adopted that recommendation, forwarded the bill that Mr. Sherman reported to you in 2012, and that was enacted. And each session since, the Bankers Association has come in with bills to revert the alternative from B to A, and this is this session's iteration of that effort. That's sort of the background just in terms of process of how this bill got to you today. I want to just speak briefly on a couple of points. I should mention lawyers on the committee. This hearing has been approved for 1 hour of continuing legal education credit. So be sure to turn in your CLE forms for this. Let me tell you why the Oregon Law Commission felt that alternative B in terms of debtor's name was the appropriate policy choice in Oregon. And then I'll tell you why it doesn't create the issues of uniformity that have been suggested to you in terms of interstate transactions and interstate banking activities. First, you have electronically we provided to you that basically the 10 reasons that the Uniform Law Commission first adopted or recommended alternative B and recommends that we continue with it. But I want to just touch on one most important, and that is the protections that current law in with the use of alternative B provide for your occasional unsophisticated filers. Understand that when you file a financing statement, the name that you put on that financing statement, when you're a secured party, when you're a seller or a lender, the name of the debtor that you put on that financing statement is critical because, as you heard today, if you don't get that name right, then your interest is not going to be perfected and stands to be stepped in front of by a later interest. Of course, the great majority of transactions in secured transactions under Article 9 are conducted by banks because banks do the majority of lending, but not all. Mr. Chair, you used an example that was close to one that I was going to use, and I'll share it just briefly with you. That sort of brings home why we thought for Oregon alternative B was the better policy. Imagine a scenario, and this is not at all far flung. This is a very common or typical kind of scenario. An auto parts store owner in Dallas, who's owned his store for 30 years and wants to get rid of the darn thing so he can go south and retire. Well, typically in a small business like that, a bank is not going to finance the purchase of it for a buyer. And small business transactions like that occur usually on seller financing. And so we have this fellow who's going to sell the business, maybe to a friend from the Rotary Club who's always wanted, or maybe an employee that's worked there for forever and would like to step up now as the owner. And so because we don't have bank financing involved, the seller, the owner of the store, says, well, look, we'll sell it for $110,000. You give me a $10,000 down payment. I'll take a note for the balance, and I'll file a financing statement. He knows to do that because he attended a Chamber of Commerce class on small business about 3 years ago, and he heard about financing statements. And so that's how they structure it. Takes $10,000 down, a promissory note for the balance, and he cashes in his other retirement and goes down to Arizona to enjoy his retirement there. Well, he files the financing statement under the name that he's known, this employee forever, Dave Johnson, and feels pretty good about that. But after a couple of years, Dave Johnson's having a little trouble with cash flow at the business, and he goes to the bank to ask for a line of credit loan to help support his operation. The bank is willing to do that and offers a line of credit loan, and the bank, being sophisticated, looks at the driver's license, files the financing statement under David P. Johnson, and everyone goes forward until he defaults and now isn't paying either the seller or the bank. And the seller, whose business this was, whose nest egg this was, has to come back to Oregon and says, well, I guess I'll just have to realize on my security interest and take the business back and try and build it back up again so I can sell it again someday, only to find that he has been replaced in prior position by the bank. And the way this happens, believe it or not, is that people do these transactions without lawyers. And you can say, well, they should have had a lawyer. And I've told many clients that when they come in to see me for the first time after the deal has gone sideways. And we had a real concern that our alternative B creates a very narrow target, a much narrower target for that financing statement that is more likely to be missed by your occasional and unsophisticated filers than it is by your sophisticated and high-volume filers like banks. So to that extent, it disadvantages our Main Street businesses, farmers, people who in who may do this once in their lifetime or very rarely. And even if you have a notice on the website at the or Secretary of State's office, they're still going to miss. Whereas Alternative B, in that same story, under Alternative B, the seller would still be protected because he used a name that is a true name that's identifiable for the debtor. That's really one of the principal reasons the Oregon Law Commission felt Alternative B was the appropriate. It does not disadvantage banks. Banks can still use driver's licenses names, and they'll be fully perfected when they file. It also does not disadvantage banks on the search end, and here's why. Because financing statements under Article 9 are not the only things that get filed in the Secretary of State's office. When a bank is doing, or when anyone is doing a search for liens, they're not just looking for Article 9 financing statements. They're looking for tax liens that may be filed at the Secretary of State's office as well. Tax liens don't follow these rules. So they are always going to have to do a broader name search anyway. Dave Johnson, David J. Johnson, David John Johnson, banks are going to have to be aware because that tax lien that may be there prior to any interest that the bank would be filing under will not follow these debtors' name rules. And so the banks are still going to have to do a broad name search. And so that's why using Alternative A really doesn't substantially affect uniformity, because the search function still has to be done the same way. What it really affects is those occasional and unsophisticated filers who are more likely to miss the target and then lose their security interest to a later filed interest by a secured party that knows to hit the target and get that right. I want to stop with that, or we'll have to give you an hour and a half of CLE credit before we get done. But the bottom line is we see Alternative B as being protective of unsophisticated filers, but not at the disadvantage of banks or other high-volume secured parties who also use the system. Let me just say that one of the reasons that we are comfortable in this is that the Oregon Secretary of State's UCC search process is highly sophisticated and captures a broad range of names. If you enter Dave Johnson, you're going to see every iteration of Dave Johnson's, David Johnson's, David Jane J. Johnson's, and it gives you a very broad picture of the people out there. So it's not as if it's a hide-and-seek game of trying to find the name on the UCC search function at the Secretary of State's office. They were also a member of the work group, by the way, that the Oregon Law Commission used. And so because we have that very broad search function, we were comfortable that Alternative B was the better alternative, coupled with the fact that we do not have an easily accessible and searchable driver's license database. Individuals can't access that the way you can a UCC search, the names in the UCC record. So for all those reasons, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm sorry, one last thing. We knew that the numbers were not going our way. We did this in 2012. We knew that in 2013-14, states were trending to Alternative A. So, knowing that this bill was coming this session, we convened the Oregon Law Commission last summer in September to revisit the recommendation the Law Commission made 3 years ago. Said, look, the numbers are not breaking in favor of Alternative B. We are in the minority of states that have adopted Alternative B. Given that, do we want to accede to the Bankers Association's change to go to Alternative A for the sake of the numbers? Law Commission heard about an hour's worth of testimony. The Bankers Association was represented and presented testimony, discussion in the Law Commission, and at the end of that last September, when these numbers were known to us in terms of how the states were moving, the Law Commission voted with one dissenting vote to affirm its recommendation and support for Alternative B. So we have that as a recent reaffirmation of the policy recommendation the Law Commission made 3 years ago. I want to give these folks some time, and I'll be happy to answer questions, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Mark Comstock. I'm an attorney practicing here in Salem. I've practiced in the commercial and creditors' rights area for about 30 years. And I'm also a member of the Oregon Law Commission and sat on the work group and regularly practice in this area. I also speak from my experience, and I have submitted written testimony previously in this consideration of this bill. I also submitted it late yesterday, and hopefully it gets to you. I had this exact fact situation come across my desk, and it was similar to the situation that Chair Holvey identified. And it was a farmer who self-financed the sale to a person of a tractor, and this person, he knew this person as Richard Harris, but the and he did document the transaction with a promissory note and a security agreement form from the local stationery store, and filed financing statements in both Oregon and California with the name Richard Harris, who he has known for a few years. Well, Richard Harris's driver's license number, or name, is Leon Richard Harris. So it was wrong. Mr. Harris defaulted on the payments of the tractor, and that's when the farmer came to me saying, how do I enforce this? I guess I need my tractor back. Well, that was when the issue of the name on the financing statement came to fore. Luckily, we were able to get it resolved without filing a lawsuit, but it was the issue. Under the proposed alternative A language, the farmer would be out of luck. It was not the name on the driver's license, and he would simply be out of luck on his security, because Richard Harris had a blanket farm credit UCC that was filed in both Oregon and Washington, blanket saying all equipment. So that would make it so the tractor was part of that equipment, right, and farm credit would get the benefit of the foreclosure on the tractor, and not my farmer client who sold the tractor to him. I want to point out that the codification of the Uniform Commercial Code in Oregon is not uniform. It's not uniform in any of the states, because there are alternatives. And if you really get down in the weeds, Senator Doherty didn't want to get down in the weeds, and I'm not going to get down there.
Mm-hmm. Don't call me a senator.
Excuse me. <You're representative. Sir? laughs> Excuse me. I do apologize.
That's okay.
I want to make sure that the committee is aware that every adoption in various states
are not uniform. You look at the some of the adoption notes, and you will see Oregon, this particular part, it has non-uniform language. Alternative A is the situation where it is a gotcha, and it does not protect the unsophisticated lender. And alternative B does pick that up at no, Mr. Shetterly identified, at no real cost to anyone else. You certainly can use the safe harbor of the driver's license name, but this picks up the other possible names that are available. So I don't want to read my testimony, but I would be pleased to answer any questions.
Thank you. Would you like to provide us anything that hasn't been said yet?
Chairman Hovey, my name is Walter Raymond Gowell from McMinnville. I also practice law, and I was also on the commission. And I know that, that's my name because that's what it says on my driver's license. However, every other piece of plastic in my wallet has something other, you know, either Walt or Walter or Walter R., but none of them have what's on my driver's license. And and I don't even sign my name Walter Raymond. It's always Walter R., which is very common in common usage. The reason I say that is because this alternative A requires that only one form of identification will be sufficient to identify a debtor on a financing statement, and if that is not used, that financing statement is ineffective, and most people filing it will be unaware that it's ineffective until some later time when they find out that that a bank has stepped in front of them. Mr. Shetterly noted, the method of verifying the required form of identification on alternative A is the most recently issued driver's license. And to know that you have the right name, you have to search the DMV records in order to get that information. In my testimony, I put in a couple of pages, several pages, related to the process that you have to go through to get an account with DMV, and the fact that only certain businesses, attorneys, and others who regularly practice in the area of credit can actually get an account at DMV and receive online access to this personal information. The small guy, the person that Lane was talking about in the business and the sale of the business, or the farmer who sold the tractor that Mr. Comstock was talking about, they do not have an account. They will not have access to that verification of DMV online information. And I believe that this legislation is all about computer searches. It's all about the ability to access information online easily and in front of a terminal. And so the problem with this legislation is that while if you look at the industry, 99.9% of all the banks would have an online account with DMV, and they have a right to have such, the small person who is dealing with a isolated transaction that may be very important to them, it may involve their lives, their livelihood and their life's savings that they're selling to somebody and financing themselves. They do not have that access. They don't have a right to get an account. They can't verify online that the most recent issued identified driver's license is that name that they're being presented, Tim Martinez indicated, even if somebody whips out their driver's license, how do you know that's the most recent name? You do it through verification. So in my view, and this was persuasive to me when we sat in the law commission and we had representatives from the DMV on the commission serving at that time, and the question came up, can we search DMV records? Can anyone search DMV records to verify the most recently issued name on the current driver's license? And the answer was no. We have privacy laws that protect the privacy of information of driver's licenses. Would you be in favor of amending these statutes in conjunction with this so that we could have create that kind of access? No, they were not in favor of amending those statutes. So you've created what becomes a non-level playing field where certain businesses can qualify for an account that allows them access to DMV personal information, but the entire world of potential creditors does not. And that, to me, what that seems to do is serve uniformity at the expense of equity. And so I think that's, to me, that was a very persuasive reason why this change should not occur until people can do it. Anybody can do an online search the way they can currently search Uniform Commercial Code records online at the Secretary of State's office. So, for instance, if the Secretary of State had an integrated database of driver's license names that somebody could search to find out what is the name, that would make it make more sense to me. But lacking that, and given the privacy laws we have and the limited access that people have to accounts at DMV, it seems to me that it's not appropriate to treat people differently coming to the table who have to satisfy the same requirement. In my 34 years, I've never run into a circumstance where, unlike Mark, where the identity of somebody has been so indefinite that it couldn't be determined. We have long-standing case law to deal with that issue in Oregon. Every state has. And alternative A basically, as Mark Shetterly indicated, narrows the target that you have to hit, the bullseye you have to hit to have a valid financing statement. The law has basically said if you use any name that I could be generally identified under in Oregon, that's sufficient. And now we're changing that rule and saying that's not sufficient. So that concerns me as a practicing attorney who deals with smaller businesses and agricultural people every day. I'm not so much worried about the lawyers. They can take care of themselves. But I do worry about people who try and navigate the system without professional help. We shouldn't make it so complicated that they have a significant risk in trying to comply with the law. And I'll stop there and take any questions.
How much CLE was that?
And Burton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you guys for, first of all, serving on the commission. Volunteered a lot of time. And you also came down here to share your perspective with us today. So I really appreciate that, and I want to say that because I don't mean to demean that by my question, which is this really that big of a deal? I mean, you've never seen it in your 34 years of practice. You've encountered one. Let's pretend we were to pass option A. Wouldn't consumer behavior, even amongst unsophisticated parties, adapt pretty quickly to simply write what's on the driver's license? It's a pretty clear, bright-line rule. Is it? This applies in 45 other states. The sky has not fallen, as far as I can tell. Why is this a big deal? Why so much angst over it?
I'll take a step. Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Barton. First of all, the concern that I would have about this is that while the great majority of transactions may not be affected by this, the ones that are going to be very significant to the individuals involved. So to me, that is significant. The other that I guess I've heard is you're almost reversing sort of the question. The question shouldn't be why should we keep the law the same. The question should be what's the policy reason for changing the law? What bad outcomes have there been that say we need a change in the law? Here, really, the only reason you heard effectively was, well, other states have done it, and we want to be like them. And to me, the burden of proof, I guess, really should be on the other side to demonstrate the bad outcomes that have occurred under current law that need to be relieved by a change in the law. And we haven't had those. So for me, status quo says we've got a system that's working, and I haven't heard a case made why we should change that system to go to something new that will be different and that will affect at least some transactions. Not many, but the ones they do will be very significant to the people they affect.
If I make a comment, if I may, my perhaps unintentionally rude question of is this a big deal does apply to both the proponents and opponents of this bill with equal force. To the extent perhaps some of my colleagues in this committee are wondering where the last hour of their lives went and why. quite seriously, and they might be looking perhaps to some of us who are lawyers, you're not alone. I don't really understand why this is a huge fight either way. So
Let me respond by saying that Chairman Holvey and members of the committee, When I indicated that in 34 and a half years I've not run into litigation involving priority ballots, it's because people have been able to use various denominations of names which could be easily searched at the Uniform Commercial Code offices with an expanded search and which function very adequately. I would expect after adoption of Alternative A, that the number of priority battles based upon somebody having missed the target would expand significantly, and there would be litigation that would not have occurred otherwise, and it'll be to the disadvantage of the small and unsophisticated filer.
I wonder what happened the last 3 months of my life.
Guardian. Okay, hopefully this is a very simple question that has a simple answer. If Alternative A is so bad, how come, one, the banks want it, which they're the ones that are doing the major lending, and two, why do we have it in 45 states?
Mr. Chair, Representative Doherty, I'll take a shot at that. And this is not to cast aspersions on banks. They will be benefited by Alternative A. That's the reason they want it, because it does allow them because it makes the target narrower, and they're the sharpshooters. It gives them the leg up over those other unsophisticated filers. So it's good business for banks, and I can't begrudge them that. Other states, why have so many other states have adopted it? Because most states, I'll tell you, don't have anything like the Oregon Law Commission that takes a look at this at the granular level and looks at it, you know, what's the policy before it gets to you. And so most of these bills, most of these Article 9 bills have come into the legislatures as bankers' bills. And so they're drafted with Alternative A, and that's the way they're presented. And there's really no, you're right, it's not the kind of thing where there's a lobby out there for Alternative B that's going to be organized and coming in and opposing a UCC 9 bill that has Alternative A. So when a bill comes in, it's a UCC, it's a Uniform Law Commission bill, amending Article 9, Bankers Association's presenting it. It's easy. Here in Oregon, we've had the reason this has become an issue is just because the Law Commission looked at this and actually identified some policy considerations here and is defending its policy recommendation.
Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just my question on this, to me, it seems like common sense and logic that whoever is the originator of the first note or loan on a piece of property should always be the first, period. Why is that not statute? Why is it not written that way? Hmm. And then you do seconds and everything after that, but whoever writes that first loan on a piece of property should be number one. Should that not be the way the system works?
You know, the Uniform Commercial Code is designed to be first in time, first in right, that whole concept. However, this Alternative A turns that upside down in the sense that a later filer who uses the driver's license name prevails over the earlier filer who used the more common usage name. So that it changes that first in time, first in right principle, and is inconsistent with that principle, and it does so for the purposes of uniformity and ease of searching, and so I believe it does violate that basic equity principle. I'd like to make one more comment, and one of the questions that was asked by Representative Barton early on of the proponents was, does this have any effect on real property? And it has one effect that's important, and that is that in a trust deed on real property that acts as a security interest on fixtures and that is filed as one document in the real property records as both a mortgage and a fixture filing, The title companies invariably desire that the identity of the party filing the trust deed be that shown on the title report, which is the identity with which they took title. That's okay. So how somebody took title to property is the way that the title company wants the trust deed to read, not how it reads on their driver's license. And so for the purposes of filing a trust deed, you may have a different name, and you probably will have a different name because so few people go by their full spelled out first, middle, and last name. Most people go by their first name and last name, or their first name, middle initial, and last name. So trust deeds will typically be at variance, and title companies will have a preference for the vested name that was used when people took title to real property. In that sense, it does have an effect. And there's a conflict between the title companies and this alternative A.
Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one question. If we adopted A, is there recourse, or does it stop all recourse from going back and proving that it was someone else who signed their name differently? I mean, as far as an attorney to go back and say no.
Yeah. Chair Holvey, Representative Barreto, outside of the transitional rule, it would prohibit that. You couldn't go back and say, well, it was really this person. That name of the driver's license is the Holy Grail. That is it. That is the only name that would be that could be used to perfect a security interest, even if everybody knew. You could not go back and later and show, well, wait a minute, I just missed the middle initial, but it was him. If you haven't used that driver's license name, you are out of luck, and there's no way to repair that.
Thank you.
Mr. Shetterly, just as a closing 2-minute answer to this mm-hmm. question.
Oh, boy. I can do it.
The legislature, as you know, has in statute commissions, advisory committees. MLAC was one we talked about yesterday. The purpose of the Oregon Law Commission is one of their purposes to review legislation and make recommendations.
It is the key responsibility of the legislature to make recommendations, and in fact, recommendations on laws proposed by the Uniform Law Commission is actually spelled out in the statute as one of the responsibilities of the Oregon Law Commission.
All right, thank you. Just wanted to follow up with that.
Gerald,
that was the closing statement. go ahead.
I'm not a lawyer. As Chair Holvey knows, I asked first grade questions, so I apologize up front. So, as a non-lawyer, in very simple terms, what I'm hearing is, if we go with this option instead of the other, we're making a mistake. Is that what you're saying?
Chair Holvey, Representative Evans, yes.
Okay. Thank you.
All righty. Thank you very much, gentlemen, for this short
question.
Little discussion. I'll close the public hearing. I apologize for those who have been waiting. This is actually an important bill, as all of them are. I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 462A, and let's open up a public hearing. Who do we want to go next? Senate Bill 141A?
Mr. Chair and committee members, this measure creates provisions for persons appointed to operate a store established by the OLCC to receive payments of 4% of the average annual sales from the previous 5 years if and only if the system for selling containers of distilled liquor changes after the person assumed operation of the store. Creates provisions to fund the business loss compensation from the proceeds of selling the assets of the OLCC. Declares an emergency. There's no amendment. Both a revenue and a fiscal statement have been issued. And the Senate vote on this measure was 30-0.
Great. Another uncontroversial bill. So with that, we'll bring up Oliver Coker. Salim Norani. Marshall Koba. Please.
Good morning. morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Marshall Koba, representing the Associated Liquor Stores of Oregon this morning in support of Senate Bill 141. Appreciate the hearing today. We have worked closely with the OLCC and appreciate Director Marks and Commissioner Patridge's involvement in this issue and working with language on, prior to the Senate hearing. This bill, we believe, adds security for liquor agents. As you'll hear from the two liquor agents with me today, the agreements that we have with the OLCC are very well written. If we're talking about the sitting in the chairs where the attorneys just sat, well written for the state, not so well written for the agents. And this adds some security. We believe it adds security for the owners through our investment, and that will lead to better stores, better consumer experiences, too. We believe that this is a security for the system. We've been talking about investment in the stores for years. And anything that helps the stores will help the current control state system. Three, we believe it helps for the safe and secure retailing of distilled spirits in the state of Oregon. If the system were to change, which we are adamantly opposed to, but you know, theft has been a significant issue in Washington. There's been articles about that recently, what's happening up there. And four, the security, we believe, for the hundreds of millions now, over $1 billion in sales and hundreds of millions of dollars in revenue that go to state and local governments through the distilled spirits program at the OLCC, we believe this is security for that. So with me are two leaders of the Associated Liquor Stores of Oregon, Oliver and Salim. Both are board members with Associated Liquor Stores of Oregon. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Chair Hovey and members of the committee, my name is Oliver Coker. I am a liquor store owner with stores in both Kaiser and Woodburn. I am also a member of the Associated Liquor Stores of Oregon. SB 141A will add security to store owners throughout Oregon with no cost to the state. This bill will be only become relevant if any, in any event, causes the OLCC to dismantle, such as privatization. In 2014, this reality was facing Oregon and 250 store owners when the grocers attempted to privatize the state's distilled spirits sales. The language in the initiative relevant to liquor stores simply stated, one, terminate all agents' contracts. Two, Oregon Department of Administrative Services shall take control of all properties and assets owned or leased by the OLCC. Three, all properties and assets are to be sold by the DAS. Four, proceeds from the disposition of properties and assets shall first be applied to offset the costs of the OLCC to implement the act. Five, the OLCC may, at its discretion and to the extent there are funds, compensate a retail sales agent for termination of their agreement. And six, provide severance payments to employees of the commission. If the current system were to change in such a way that the OLCC was prohibited from purchasing or selling distilled liquors, the provisions of SB 141A would take effect. Agents would be entitled to a business loss compensation rate of 4% on the average annual gross distilled liquor sales from the previous 5 years from that store location. For a store averaging $2 million in annual sales, this would be a one-time payment of $80,000. The business loss compensation fund would be paid from selling the assets of the OLCC, including the warehouse and inventory. With passage of SB 141A, current store owners would have the security that if the system changes, they would get back a portion of their original investment when they purchased their store. Benefits to the state, customers, and industry, including the craft distilleries of Oregon, would be: current store owners who have not modernized for years due to the privatization looming will now see the benefit of fresh paint, new fixtures, and flooring rather than saving every penny in case the state privatizes and lose their investments. Two, as current stores become available, better qualified applicants will be interested in investing a store knowing their investment is more secure. And three, the OLCC has to grow the number of stores for future revenue. Finding a pool of qualified individuals to invest in the stores as they come online will be much easier if an interested candidate knows their investment is secure. Liquor stores employ 1,400 citizens, and the industry supports several thousand jobs. In order to preserve and build on these jobs and revenue for the state, we strongly urge your support for SB 141A. I urge your support for SB 141A. Thank you.
Go ahead.
Good morning, Chair Holvey, members of the committee. My name is Salim Rani, and I'm a liquor store owner with stores in Corvallis and Springfield. The bill before you today fixes the system, which is unfair to the store owners. The current regulations provide no protection for our investment in the business. To give a little background on the issue, a newly appointed liquor store owner is required by OLCC rules to pay a goodwill or buyout equal to 4% of the average annual gross sales to the retiring store owner. whose outstanding liquor store is being purchased. The goodwill payment for an average annual sales of $2 million store amounts to $80,000. This payment is just the start. The fixtures, computer system, security system, and other essentials required for the operation of the business could add another $25,000 to $30,000. The new store agent is also required to present a plan for updating and modernizing the store upon takeover. The remodel can be as high as $50,000 to $80,000. The total investment for a new agent can range from a low of $130,000 to $190,000 to start. This does not include non-liquor inventory to stock the store. Most of us do not have that kind of capital laying around. We have to invest all of our savings, take out a second mortgage on our homes, a bank loan, and borrow from family and friends to start the business. We are still very excited to get into the business because we feel we are building a secure future. Once the loans are paid off, which may take up to 10 years, we can slowly start saving for our children's college tuition and an eventual retirement. It is quite normal to pay goodwill to acquire an existing business. The business has a value that you can sell down the road and recoup your original investment, and hopefully more by building the business and increasing sales. Unfortunately, for a liquor store in Oregon, we are required to pay a goodwill, but have no guarantees whatsoever that the value of our investment is protected for the future. Let me give you a couple of examples. Number one, OAR 845-015-190, Section 12, states verbatim, no contract rights in buyout. No agent shall have any entitlement to or expectation of receiving any buyout. The institution and continuation or termination of the buyout program constitutes unilateral regulatory action by the commission and gives no agent any contractual right or expectation in any buyout payment. The commission reserves the right to repeal or modify this rule or otherwise terminate the buyout program at any time. Number two, if the commission or the legislature decides tomorrow to change the current model of retailing distilled spirits in Oregon and privatizes the system, most grocery stores would qualify for a license to sell distilled spirits. There are over 750 stores, grocery stores, with a footprint of 10,000 square feet that would qualify for distilled spirit license. Number three, the grocery industry tried to mount a liquor privatization measure unsuccessfully last year. We are well aware of their keen interest in bringing about such a change and the revenue involved. We believe that they will continue working towards privatizing sales in Oregon. If any of the above scenario plays out, the number of liquor outlets would quadruple in Oregon. What would happen to our current liquor store sales and the value of our business investment? Who would be willing to buy our business and pay anything even close to what we were required to pay? I ask you to put yourself in our shoes and see the dilemma we are in. Where is the fairness in this equation? The liquor store owners work hard and diligently, providing good customer service, monitor closely that no minors are allowed access to alcohol, and generate a lot of revenue for the state. Are we being unreasonable in asking that our investments be protected? Even the executive director of OLCC, Stephen Marks, is aware of the potential dampening effect this has on agents' investment decisions and concerns about recouping their investments, as well as the diminishing pool of new applicants for liquor stores. This bill clearly defines the condition under which the state would protect our investment. It will not cost the state any additional sum to support this bill. If a privatization scenario comes about in the future, which we hope it doesn't, there will be no need for the assets of the Liquor Commission owns for selling distilled spirits. The monies from the sale of those assets would be more than enough to compensate the liquor store owners and have a tidy sum left over for the general fund. We have a great working relationship with OLCC and fully support the current model of retailing distilled spirits in Oregon. It provides a safe and controlled environment for liquor sales while keeping it out of the hands of minors and generates a great deal of revenue for the state. Passing the bill would incentivize agents to reinvest in their stores. which would lead to increased sales and ultimately more revenue for the state. I urge you to see the merit of the bill. We are only asking for what is fair and not to be penalized by losing not only our livelihood, but all we have worked for. Thank you for your time. Please do what is right. Champion this bill and help it pass. Thank you.
Thank you. Seeing no questions. Oh, Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If this privatization was to take place and the agent then at the store gets reimbursed for the 4%, then could he go on and gets licensed to continue in business, then can he take that 4% from the state and then use that to go right back into business as a private individual, as a licensee?
Chair Holby, Representative Barreto, that is a million-dollar question. Once you expand the pool of current outlet by 400%, yes, we would recoup part of the investment because our investment is not just the goodwill, which we are asking for. We have another additional $80,000 to $100,000 invested in the store. Would we survive? Some of us would. We would have diminished sales because the pie is only so large. And if you look at $1 billion sales currently in a biennium in Oregon, and you expand the number of stores from 250 to 1,000, it would be difficult. But it would go a long way towards helping us, you know, at least recoup some of the money. Correct.
Well, actually, I was just going to ask if the four, in that scenario, does the 4% seem like a good number to you as an agent?
We have to be pragmatic. It would be very nice if we could get that entire investment back, and I would be, you know, very appreciative if you thought that was possible. But I think, you know, with the support we have from the industry and from the commission, I think 4% is a good starting point.
Representative Kinnemer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question, under the current rules at the OLCC, how does this bill's payout provision compare to the current formula used to evaluate a buyout between an outgoing agent and a new agent?
Chair Holby, Vice Chair Kinnemer, it is exactly the formula right now. So if I was to retire, and an incoming agent would be required to pay me exactly 4% of annual gross sales. In addition to, they would have to then buy all my fixtures and my computer system, security system, which we are not asking for in this bill. But an incoming agent would be paying us for all of that currently.
It remains the same.
Correct.
Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate you bringing the bill forward, gentlemen. And don't see any other questions for you right now.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Up next, Renee Niedermeyer and Patrick Bernard.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Renee Niedermeyer. I'm the Director of Government Relations and Communications for the OLCC. Our director, Stephen Marks, couldn't be here today, and he wanted me to share his testimony with the committee. My plan is to read his remarks. They're very short, and then answer any questions that you might have. Here is his testimony. The OLCC does not have an official position on Senate Bill 141A. However, as director of the agency, I feel it's important to share background as you make your deliberations. The agents at the Oregon's liquor system have collectively moved the OLCC to a projected $1.13 billion in revenue in gross sales projected for the 2015-17 biennium. As the system has grown, the agents have invested their time and capital, as you've heard earlier here today, despite several risks in the system, the risk of privatization being one of those risks. I am concerned about the potential dampening effect of this threat on the investment decisions of our existing and our future agents. Currently, the threat has dampened new store applications as concerns have risen about the ability of agents to recoup their potential agents to recoup their investments. Our agents face other risks as well. As director of the agency, I'm greatly appreciative of the work that they have done without limiting their risk under our contractual process. The OLCC has wide direct discretion to set contract terms with agents. We are now talking about expanding our system in a measured way, and I appreciate their willingness to work closely with us as we move forward. As part of our expansion process, we plan to revise our contracts in order to make both parties more accountable. As we move forward, I look forward to working with agents to put processes in place that generate new investments. The system has grown, but it can be even better as we work to create incentives to encourage remodels and relocations, to build additional stores, and to improve the customer experience. Obviously, the consideration of this bill is a legislative prerogative and not one for the OLCC itself. What I can say is that I appreciate the agent's willingness to work with us despite the risk. That work has resulted in steadily increasing revenue for the state.
Thank you. Patrick, could you introduce yourself for the record?
Good morning, Chair Holvey and members of the committee. I am Patrick Bernards from Bull Run Distilling Company, a member of the Oregon Distillers Guild and the Oregon Craft Beverage Council. First thing I want to state is that I can't sit here this morning and say that I speak for all of my peers, but I'm confident that I speak for the vast majority of my peers. I think the main point I'd like to make today, and it's really echoing what's been said here this morning, the gentleman sitting behind me and the other men and women who run our OLCC liquor stores across the state, in my particular case, account for 2/3 of my business. This last month in April, I drove a little over 1,600 miles across our state, visiting over 60 different stores. And I will tell you that they certainly do range from absolutely stunning to needing a little bit of help. and I think these gentlemen would admit that. And what's being stated here, the ability to create some security for these folks, especially those who have not taken the leap to modernize their stores, would go a long way towards not only helping them, it will obviously, again, bring in more revenue for the state of Oregon, and it will continue to help bring in revenue for myself and my peers. We've watched what's happened up north, and I can tell you to this day, however many years later it has now been, what is happening at the retail level, the store level in the state of Washington, is still very challenging for those who are small distillers in this state as well as in the state of Washington. The big box stores have not done a great job in supporting local, whereas the small stores or liquor stores here in the state of Oregon have done a tremendous job of supporting local. If these folks are able to shore up their businesses now, create a great environment, those are the folks who will have the best opportunity to go forward. Should we ever privatize, and I'll go on the record as saying I am not in favor of privatization because, again, of what we've witnessed up north. And, again, the evidence that we have seen is that is the small, what I'll call boutique shops, are the shops that will, in fact, support myself, Bull Run Distilling Company, and my more than 60 peers across the state of Oregon at this time.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Is there any questions for this group?
Representative Barton. A comment, really.
11 people on this committee, 11 different perspectives on our OLCC system. Some people love it, some people hate it, somewhere in between. But one thing I think we can all agree on is that the agents have been good partners to work with for the state. Whether you love or hate the OLCC system, it could not work without the agents, and they've always upheld their end of the bargain. And it's hard not to have a certain sympathy for them, because they are in a partnership with an entity that might, in effect, change course because of initiative. And that's they know that. They're going into it. But to the extent we can give them at least some security interest in that context, I really think they deserve it. I don't think that's a crazy request. This seems like a good idea to get there.
Thank you for those comments. I appreciate that. Any other questions, comments on this? Thank you very much for taking the time to testify on this today. Appreciate it. Was there anyone else that wanted to testify on Senate Bill 141A? Seeing none, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 141A. Stand at ease for just a moment. We're reconvening the House Committee on Business and Labor and open a work session on Senate Bill 141A.
Chair Holvey, I move Senate Bill 141A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Bart moves Senate Bill 141A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? I think Representative Barton summed up our discussion. So with that, Matthew, could we have a roll call vote, please?
Aye.
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 Yes.
Yes.
Aye.
Aye.
Representative Widener?
Aye.
Vice Chair Barton?
Aye.
Vice Chair Kenworth?
Aye.
Chair Holby?
Aye. Senate Bill 141A, having received the votes, is passed. Volunteers to carry the bill?
I'll carry it, Mr. Chair.
Representative Nose? Thank
sure,
you.
Sure, I'll do it.
With that, we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 141A. Let's open up a public hearing on. Well, before we do that, we're not going to hear Senate Bill 681 today, if anybody's waiting for that. We will be carrying that over to Wednesday. With that, I'll open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 297A.
Mr. Chair and committee members, this measure allows an applicant who's seeking a license to practice as a professional engineer, a land surveyor, or a photogrammetric mapper in Oregon to obtain qualifications for licensure in any order and make a single application to the Oregon State Board of Examiners for Engineering and Land Surveying. It enables the board to refuse a registration of an applicant who has violated statute, rule, or standards in another jurisdiction that would be the grounds for the refusal, suspension, or revocation of their license in Oregon. Permits the board to waive the examination requirement for applicants who are licensed in another jurisdiction for 25 years or more. It adds geomatic-based education programs for entry into the photogrammetry profession.
I had to carry that bill.
Identifies persons in the responsible charge of photogrammetric mapping work and broadens the work of photogrammetric mapping for responsible charge to include all work. Revises the board's authority over fees, declares an emergency. There is a proposed -A5 amendment. It replaces the word program with the word curriculum when describing the academic graduation requirements for registration as either a professional land surveyor or a photogrammetrist. Senate vote was 30-0.
Great, thank you, and I'm glad I gave you a little time to practice those words yesterday.
I had to carry that bill last time, so I had to.
So, up first, I'm going to have Michael
Hardy
and Daryl Fuller.
Indeed.
And Matthew
Cash,
perhaps.
Mm-hmm.
Good morning. If you'd introduce yourself for the record, please. Whoever's going first.
Yeah. Chair Holby, Vice Chair, members of the committee. My name is Michael Hardy. I'm a native Oregonian and registered in the professional engineer for the last, practiced in Oregon for the last 20 years.
Thank you, sir.
I have been involved with the Ausbils board for the last 5 or 10 years, and consider myself, I'd say, a subject matter expert in licensure laws through some of my history as the past president of the National Society of Professional Engineers, primarily an interested practitioner. And I am here to support the bill as it was introduced into the House. I was involved in the hearing process, testimony development on the Senate side, and was very concerned about some of the amendments that were proposed in that venue. And as the bill comes to the House, I'm here to support the bill, and lots of technical reasons that I won't go into. I do see this as enabling the Ausbils board to keep pace with changes in technology, changes in processes, changes in procedures. There are some controversial aspects, but I do believe the concerns that I've heard can be, specifically on the engineering side, can be addressed through the well-established rulemaking process that would follow if this legislator approves the measure. Thank you.
Please speak. Introduce yourself for the record.
My name is Matthew Cash. I'm an electrical engineer and here representing the Professional Engineers of Oregon, which is a chapter of the National Society of Professional Engineers. Good morning, everyone. We submitted our testimony, a written letter and testimony, and I'm here to answer any questions about that, as well as reiterate our support for Senate Bill 297. And the Professional Engineers of Oregon stand for Learning, Licensure, and Leadership. And we believe that this bill enhances that for the most part. As Michael stated, there are some concerns, but our board voted to approve the bill, or to support the bill and endorse it as it left the Senate. So if there's any questions or anything like that, I'm happy to answer them. I'm a licensed electrical engineer in 22 states and have a practice here in Oregon. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, in solidarity with my good friend Mr. Martinez, my name is Darrell William Fuller, for the record, and I'm here on behalf of the Professional Land Surveyors of Oregon in support of Senate Bill 297A. The bill came from Ausbils. It was a bill that was generated by the board in an effort to make the process of being registered as a engineer, land surveyor, photogrammetrist a more streamlined process. As the current statute is written, there are certain milestones that you have to meet in order to be registered, and the statute's written in such a way that you have to meet the milestones in a certain order. And what this does is rewrite those statutes, and it permits the person to toll the requirements to be registered in whatever order it makes the most sense for them. So you don't have to get one before the other. And it's my understanding is this the bill was brought forward primarily because the testing requirement, which used to be done at a state level, is now done at a national level, and we don't have control over when those tests are scheduled. And so this would allow somebody to do things what would be considered out of order now in terms of the statutory structure. It wouldn't require it to be done in a certain order. So we think it's a good idea. We certainly support the bill. The Professional Land Surveyors requested the A5 amendments, which you should have before you. It's a small technical one-word change that have circulated among the stakeholders and haven't seen any opposition to. As it regards specifically land surveyors, the statute or the bill as written talks about a land surveying program at a college, and there are a lot of colleges that don't have specific land surveying programs. They would have a curriculum that is similar to a curriculum in a program that is a specific land surveying program. But we don't want somebody to get stopped from taking the exam or from becoming registered as a land surveyor because their degree is in something else besides land surveying, even though the curricula is almost identical to a land surveying curriculum. So what we've proposed in the A5 amendments, which I encourage you to support, is we simply change the word from land surveying program to a land surveying curriculum. So they may actually degree in something other than land surveying, because not a lot of colleges have degrees in land surveying, but they would have the same or an equivalent education to a land surveying program. And so with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions. This is a good bill. It's good for the industry. There's no opposition to it or to the A5 amendments as far as I know. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Questions? So just out of curiosity, I suppose, what are the issues that still there's some concern about that you feel will be dealt with in rulemaking? Are they something that we should hear about?
As was mentioned, some of the order that things are progressed in, we have more freedom to follow what the order that makes sense, and that's a change from the status quo. Practitioners have the feeling that we're degrading the license by doing that. My personal perspective is that it's keeping up with the times. You know, the license I took 20 years ago is not the same. It's not the same industry. It's not the same workplace 20 years ago as it is today. And we're just trying to keep up with the way technology happens. There were concerns about I think it's Section 5 talks about allowing the board to make rules regarding evaluating experience in lieu of a structured college degree. Feeling is that allowing experience instead of formal education again would degrade the licensure. I have a lot of faith in the state board that they're not going to do that. The words that we hear a lot, protecting the health, safety, welfare of the public, is paramount to the board. The board members are largely licensed members, although there are also public members on the board. I do not believe the board would allow that to happen. I believe those considerations can be addressed in the rulemaking process. It is a public process, and so I have faith that that process will work the way it's supposed to and that those concerns can be addressed.
Thank you. You have something to add to that?
Just that some of our members have expressed concern about foreign interests and foreign experience and becoming an automatic licensure in Oregon without maybe that foreign experience or educational background being thoroughly investigated. So, for example, I believe the bill has provisions for 25 years experience requirement, and we would support that. We would not support a reduction of that.
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry if I might. The Section 5 he referred to, which allows the board by rule to look at other education and experience for equivalency purposes, it's my understanding, and the staff from Osbiel's is here in the room, so if I'm wrong, they'll let me know, but that is current statute. But when they rewrote the whole statute to make sense, the Section 5 actually is not new, and it's authority that they currently have.
The section regarding the foreign licensure, the bar that has been set by the staff has been 25 years. And that's not intent. The intent of that is not to change the licensure. It's really to deal with an administrative issue, is that most jurisdictions don't have records of what that equivalent test was 25 years ago. In the last 25 years, they have pretty decent records, but the records don't go back that far. So we're trying to deal with an administrative issue that, because it has the word foreign in it, some people think we're trying to give things away, and we're not.
So I know that I appreciate that, and just the whole idea of, you know, providing credit for people's experience is sometimes extremely important when it comes to certification or licensure or what have you. I know that earlier there was some conversations about hydrography. Did I say that right?
Mm-hmm.
And being that, you know, I guess if you look at the description of engineering and land surveying, it appears that hydrography would be included in that, yet they're quite different than land surveying, for example. So the idea that they would need a license in land surveying to do hydrography was something that was kind of brought up, and I know that that amendment has been, you know, kind of scuttled for now as far as moving that forward, but I think the conversation was an appropriate conversation to have, though I don't think that a hydrographer, you know, from my research on it anyway, as far as I got, and I think we have a couple people here to speak to that perhaps, they don't really have a recognized license under the engineering or land surveying, and probably is not appropriate for them to pass a land surveying or engineering licensure test, but it made me wonder why they don't have a certification of their own that would be unique to them specifically, as opposed to being, you know, an engineering license. So I was just kind of curious if the board's going to have conversations about that topic in the future.
Mr. Chair, on behalf of PLSO, it's, as you've indicated, an issue that is not ripe yet, and I anticipate there'll be some very interesting conversations during the interim about that.
Yeah, I just want to express an interest that I'd like to be informed about those conversations, on how that moves forward, and what that is. So with that, I appreciate you coming forward. I appreciate we don't have paperwork on the amendments at this point, so we'll move this on another day. Thank you. Up next, I'd like to have a Mike Stetcher.
Yes, sir.
And Jason McGallen. McGalen?
Answer to it all.
That's a good thing. Good morning, and welcome. I know you're here to speak about Senate Bill 297 and perhaps some other topics. I don't know.
Yeah. So good morning, Chairman Holvey and members of the committee. Thank you for allowing us a couple minutes of your time. We'll try to be brief. My name is Mike Stetcher. I'm the president of Solmar Hydro, a hydrographic surveying company that I've owned and operated for over 11 years. I currently operate facilities in Eugene and Portland. I've been performing hydrographic surveys exclusively since 1998 and began my career at the National Oceanic Atmospheric Administration's Office of the Coast Survey. I am also a certified hydrographer by the National Society of Professional Surveyors and American Congress on Surveying and Mapping, and a licensed U.S. Coast Guard captain. We are here this morning to express our opposition to a proposed amendment to Senate Bill 297, Amendment Number 4, that would require a professional land surveyor for, in the words of the amendment, making any survey of surface waters, underwater areas, or submerged lands. This is a proposed amendment to ORS 672.005. At the moment, it seems that the organizations that were supporting enactment of this amendment have taken a step back and are no longer advocating for it. However, since it has been proposed, we feel the need to state for public record the reasons why we oppose this amendment should there be a scenario in which it is debated further. First, for those who are not familiar with hydrography or hydrographic surveying, it is essentially underwater mapping using deployed acoustic remote sensing equipment from vessels within the inshore and offshore environments, including navigable and non-navigable waterways. It is a science of measurement and description of features which affect maritime navigation, marine construction, dredging, benthic habitat assessment, marine environmental remediation, offshore natural resource exploration, offshore renewable energy, underwater utilities, submerged infrastructure, hydroelectric facilities, and so on. Strong emphasis is placed on soundings, shorelines, tides, currents, seabed, and submerged obstructions that relate to the previously mentioned activities. It also encompasses the terms described in the proposed amendment, making any survey of surface waters, underwater areas, or submerged lands. It's a profession that is not currently recognized by the state of Oregon, but has a long and distinguished history in the United States of America, dating back to the 1800s. Hydrographic surveyors have traditionally been trained through established hydrographic surveying programs and careers at organizations such as the U.S. Navy, National Oceanic Atmospheric Administration, National Geospatial Agency, and the United States Army Corps of Engineers. These agencies are responsible for ensuring safe navigation in the open ocean, coastal, and inland waterways, and are the responsible parties for the development of federal navigation charts and geospatial defense products. Moreover, two universities, the University of New Hampshire and the University of Southern Mississippi, each have established academic programs in which graduates obtain internationally recognized hydrographic training and certification. These universities and federal agencies are at the forefront of the advancement of hydrographic surveying science, technology implementation, and methodologies. Approval and enactment of the proposed amendment to Senate Bill 297 would render it illegal for these highly qualified academic graduates in form of NOAA, Army Corps, National Geospatial Agency, and U.S. Naval officers and employees to practice hydrographic surveying in the state of Oregon unless under the direct supervision of an Oregon-licensed professional land surveyor. Land surveying and hydrographic surveying are very different sub-disciplines in the broader fields of surveying, engineering, and remote sensing. Though they share similarities, they require different techniques, equipment, training, methodologies, experience, and examination are inherently different. An individual trained and experienced in land surveying may not be qualified to complete hydrographic surveys, much like a hydrographer may not be qualified to perform legal boundary surveys. At present, a professional land surveyor's academic curriculum, experience, and examination criteria do not include the most basic concepts of hydrographic surveying or acoustic theory, which are paramount to completing accurate, safe, and quality hydrographic surveys. Hydrography is generally not a requirement within the area of education, expertise, or examination requirements of a registered professional land surveyor in the state of Oregon. Moreover, time spent performing hydrographic surveying does not qualify as required experience to sit for the professional land surveyor examination, according to Osbiels.
Thank you, Chair Holvey, and the committee for listening to us today. My name is Jason Magelin. I'm a coastal engineer and a hydrographer, a certified hydrographer. I'm a professional engineer in the state of Oregon, and I'm also the current president of the American Society of Civil Engineers Oregon section. For the past several years, Mr. Stetcher and I and several of our colleagues in the hydrographic surveying profession and outside of it have been proactively working with the Osbiels to create a distinguished hydrographic surveying technical profession, one that's based on rigorous education, experience, expertise, and testing. In these meetings, the Osbiels board members have debated the proper course for categorizing and regulating hydrographic surveying as well. It's not an easy problem. Public participants with us have included certified hydrographers, professional engineers, professional land surveyors, and graduate and undergraduate level educators. During the course of tracking the progress of this amendment, number four, we amassed a lengthy list of educators, surveyors, and engineers who are also opposed to its enactment. And the names are that we've amassed are listed at the end of a letter that we submitted to the House committee via email as of yesterday. And they also are in support of our testimony this morning. Approval and enactment of such an amendment would directly circumvent all the efforts that we've made recently with Osbiels to find a solution that's amenable to all. It would likely have immediate detrimental impacts on the livelihood of currently practicing hydrographers while directly benefiting a select few. And further, it could jeopardize maritime safety and may have immediate and direct negative impacts on commerce and the marine and inland water navigable environments. If the amendment number four to Senate Bill 297 were to be enacted in its present form, experienced and qualified hydrographers who do not meet the state board's professional land survey requirements would be legally prohibited from surveying in Oregon. And moreover, professional engineers like myself, who also are qualified to complete hydrographic surveyors, would not be allowed because I am not a professional land surveyor defined by the state of Oregon. Therefore, we urge you to oppose establishment of this proposed amendment until such time as the issue can be thoroughly studied and all stakeholders involved. And we are open to and interested in a discussion of what type of certification and licensure makes sense for hydrographers and welcome any discussion at any time. In being proactive about this issue, Oregon kind of stands in the position has an opportunity to be a national leader in developing a hydrographic surveying technical definition and professional recognition process. So thank you very much for your time. Welcome any questions now or at a later date.
Thank you. I appreciate you coming forward, and I think everybody's, at least from my knowledge in a way, is kind of in agreement with you. I think it is interesting and maybe overdue to really establish a certification or license for hydrography and perhaps within the land surveying and engineering board purview, but to have a separate certification seems like it would, something like that would make sense, and I'm not exactly sure which of the engineering and land surveying criteria would be pertinent, but that's for you smart people to figure out who know your subject matter. But I think there is perhaps a need, you know, not just in Oregon, but around the country to elevate that licensure, if you will, or certification, and so it's recognized by states to avert conflicts in the future. So with that, I hope that your conversations move forward, that's about it. I don't see any other comments or questions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Anybody else, Marshall? You want to make a?
Very brief. Mr. Chair, good morning. My name is Marshall Koba, representing the American Council of Engineering Companies. ACEC Oregon has about 110 member firms and 3,500 employees in the state of Oregon. We're supportive of Senate Bill 297A with the Dash 5 amendments, the PLSO amendments, and look forward to your support. Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate that. Any questions for Marshall? Well, hopefully we can keep this hydrography conversation going as well.
I believe there will be a continued conversation into the interim.
Great. Appreciate that. With that, I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 297A. And committee, we will not be meeting on Friday. And we will be meeting on Monday at 8:30.
Here, here, he's a jolly
guy. I take back some of the bad things I've said.
With that, I'll adjourn the House Committee on Business.
In the middle. What was that?
I just stuck my gum in the wrapper for him.
Doesn't make sense.
Actually, I was getting.
Doesn't make sense.
Actually, I was getting.